I just want to have you on a couple more times so that you can be on more times than Peter Sankoff has been on.
I won't say no.
Coming to you from our nation's capital, this is Politicoast. Today is December 2nd, 2017, and this is episode 64. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod, and support the show at patreon.com/politicoast. In this special No Scott and Ian's in Ottawa Again edition, we're cutting in segments from two guest appearances I did with our Ottawa podcast friends at The Docket and The Boys in Short Pants. But first, I have to thank our premier sponsor, Lindsay Tedds, for helping make this show possible. And we now have a new second premier sponsor, Blake Hodson, who you can follow on Twitter at BaconUs, B-A-C-O-N-U-S. So thanks, Blake and Lindsay. First up, we'll play a couple segments from my guest appearance on The Docket with Michael Spratt and Emily Tammen. We talk about the LGBT apology and the new Supreme Court pick. If you want to hear the full episode with our entire conversation, go to michaelspratt.com and find episode 68.
Well, I think the apology that the PM gave today is a pretty significant it's a pretty significant thing.
Do you want to maybe tee this one up, Ian?
Sure. I think it was yesterday afternoon, but
Who knows when this goes out,
so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But this had been in the works for a while, and I think was one of the things the Liberals might have they promised so much in the election. Who remembers it anymore? I think they're trying to hope we all forget.
Yeah.
But this was a apology to the LGBTQ plus community for historic wrongs and discriminations that the government had some hand in, whether that was direct criminalization of buggery, indecency, anal intercourse, or even just policies within the military, within the civil service that I think the Prime Minister called it like a witch hunt to get the gays out.
Yeah.
So it was a wide-ranging apology. And along with it came an announcement of $145 million to go to compensation to those people who had their careers sidelined, and it had another and a chunk of change that went to help sort of recognize this discrimination, some reconciliation efforts, and just helping us learn a bit more about how far we've come, I guess, as a country. I mean, not to say discrimination against the community is over,
because
we go to the TWU case tomorrow,
but
that we have recognized that these were wrongs committed.
Yeah, and I was listening on the CBC yesterday to some discussion about it, so obviously I know it was yesterday. But and they were talking about actually how, number one, how many of these policies were still, you know, directly or indirectly kind of in effect up until not that long ago, that these are not, we're not talking about discrimination that had been wholly eliminated, you know, by 1940 by any means. And also just how little a lot of Canadians really understand about this really institutionalized systemic discrimination by the state. So I think the reconciliation piece, I think, is really important.
Yeah, it's something that we talked about on a past podcast, actually, when there was some very good journalism about the last individual is actually incarcerated because he violated some of these very discriminatory anti-LGBTQ laws. And so I think that there can be sort of, especially when you're coming from a more progressive standpoint, to sort of underestimate how recent these issues were and how devastating they were, because they ultimately sometimes resulted in incarceration, in separation of parents from their kids, in ostracization from communities, and some very severe employment consequences. So I think it was well deserved. I think that everyone said the right things in Parliament. I think that some people said things in Parliament that contradict things that they have said very recently about those communities, Andrew Scheer, in Parliament. But despite the fact that, you know, you can call Andrew Scheer out for very outdated views that he articulated only a few short years ago, there was none of that on the floor in the House of Commons. And I think that is a very good thing.
Yeah, it is. But I also think, you know, it's important that we recognize this step for what it is and acknowledge its significance, which it is, but also that, you know, unfortunately, rights holders, minority groups do have to maintain a certain vigilance about ensuring that their rights continue to be maintained, because I know there are still issues where the government has some work to do. One of them, you know, is in relation to another of their many campaign promises that they would end the so-called blood ban, which is the prohibition against blood donation by gay men. This is something that they promised. They came into power, then they kind of flip-flopped on it. And I'm not saying it's the same thing as excluding someone from, you know, an employment opportunity, or, you know, asking someone to choose between the person they love and their job or their liberty, or, you know, but it's still, I mean, I think it still goes to show that there's still work that needs to be done, but I'm not going to take away from the fact that I think this is an important symbolic and concrete step the government's taken.
Well, and they also introduced this bill yesterday to allow people to have their records expunged, or even their deceased relatives who had been convicted of any of these things. And I guess this was modeled off bills used in other jurisdictions. New Zealand, I think, came up first. I think the question I sort of had is, as criminal defense lawyer, what's the simple explanation of what an expunging is? Just so we're clear.
Well, there are various mechanisms to sort of remove the stigma of a criminal record. In the past, we called them pardons. Now you have to apply for record suspensions. But there's also clemency and other issues. And so, I mean, the simplest way that you can look at it is this is a statutory way outside the current framework to have these convictions removed from someone's record or historical record. What it seems like with this bill is that there isn't going to be the application fee and sort of the other processes, and so there can be more attention given to righting these historical wrongs without, I mean, because all of these individuals would be eligible for a pardon or a record suspension and could get one, but this is a mechanism to fast-track that, streamline it.
And it's something more than a pardon, I think. Like, it's or at least it's, that's the way it was being presented by the government.
That's right. It's not it's more of a recognition that you didn't do anything wrong, that you shouldn't have been charged in the first place, rather than sort of a forgiveness for past wrongs.
Exactly, yeah, like a pardon.
A pardon carries that admission of guilt, like, yes, I did this, but...
Yeah, like that you've been convicted and it's not negating your conviction, but rather saying because you've been of good behavior since that time, we're going to basically, as part of your ongoing rehabilitation, by removing it from the record, it opens opportunities that are not open to people with records. This is different. This is sort of essentially saying you never should have been convicted in the first place. And it's not just a pardon. It's like the record never existed in the first place.
I think that it is also a good example that these sort of mechanisms are possible through legislation.
And why do you say that?
And there might be other instances that Ralph Goodale wants to look at.
Like what?
I mean, I can think of two off the top of my head, and that would be pardons for people who were convicted of simple marijuana possession over the last number of years, perhaps even convicted since the government announced that they were going to be legalizing marijuana.
Can I just point out, you just mentioned cannabis rate at 420?
I totally did.
Yeah,
I'm also
amazing.
Very high right now. No, I'm not. I'm not. I swear to God, I haven't smoked any marijuana right now.
Right now.
No promises going forward in July 2nd of 2018 or whenever it's legal.
Right.
I think that the other thing that this points out is that Ralph Goodale could maybe also do some work on the current pardon system, parts of which have been declared unconstitutional by courts in BC and here, something we've talked about before. So, you know, this might have been a good time to address all of those issues and package them up in one sort of omnibus piece of legislation, because that's omnibus legislation's fine. But I will say seriously that I think that it's all well and good to apologize for past historic wrongs that you may not have been a part of or that didn't happen under your watch. And this is a good thing. I think that the government should be taking a more proactive look about what's happening now that we're going to need to apologize for later on, because this is always something. There's always something that is happening right now that we will have to apologize for later, whether it's slavery or discrimination against, you know, religious groups.
Or right now I'm thinking about the status of First Nations children. And
that's
the
right.
Ongoing litigation, multiple rulings by the Human Rights Tribunal that there's discrimination happening in relation to funding, and a real expectation when this government was elected that this would be the end of this kind of protracted litigation, and to think that they just keep having to go back to court again and again. And really, you know, I've been reflecting a lot about this recently because of some reading I've been doing and stuff, but it's just how much the child welfare system for First Nations kids is starting to look a lot like residential schools, and that we've had these very public proclamations by the Prime Minister himself about residential schools and the harm that was done there, but that in a lot of ways we actually have a very similar situation that's ongoing in our country, and that the government has been given many opportunities to address, and they say they're working on it, and that's fine, but as Cindy Blackstock always says, you know, children do not have incremental childhoods, and if you wait too long with this idea of incremental rights, it's another generation lost. And so, you know, this is something that I hope that the government is thinking a lot about.
Well, the stat that I've heard thrown around, and I have no reason to doubt it, is there are more First Nations children in care right now than there were at the height of the residential school crisis, which just kind of highlights how deep that issue is.
Yeah,
so I think we need to be proactive. And the other thing that I will say, because this connects to a justice bill, is, and we've talked about this bill in the past, Bill C-39, which is a bill to repeal unconstitutional offenses that have been found to be unconstitutional, except not minimum sentences that have been found to be unconstitutional, because the government is not repealing those, even though the Supreme Court has said they're unconstitutional.
Details.
But Bill C-39 has a clause that repeals the unconstitutional and discriminatory sections of the criminal code that deal with things like anal sex and sort of other indecency provisions that were applied discriminatory in a discriminatory fashion and operated that way. This is a bill that even Michael Cooper of the Conservative Party, in his member statement yesterday, which is normally reserved for either talking about good things in your community or criticizing Bill Morneau, like that's what member statements are useful for. His member statement was, why hasn't the government moved this bill forward that we support that repeals unconstitutional offenses, including the unconstitutional section that was relied on by the trial judge in the Travis Vader case to inappropriately convict him? I don't know why the government's not moving this forward. It contains an element that is directly related to the apology that was delivered yesterday. It seems like it would have been a good time to actually put some effort to moving it forward.
Well, in Bill C-51, the new one, not the bad old one, that repeals a bunch of other random laws. I think we talked about it last time.
Crime comics,
witchcraft, blasphemy.
Alarming Her Madge.
Has cleared committee and is going already to third reading soon.
That's right.
And then it seems like it's on track to, you know, clear the Senate before they prorogue or whenever they do. But
so why do you think they're not moving that other one forward? I mean, it's probably less of a priority because in a way it doesn't really change the law. I mean, it just...
But if they're committed to cleaning up the law, there's...
Yeah.
I guess there are a couple things in 51, as you know, that are a little bit more controversial. Maybe the Liberals see those as the priority around the sexual assault. And
I don't know. It seems like this is a Bill C-39 is a bill that just cleans things up. The line that we've been given from the Justice Minister is that they're undertaking a review and an analysis of the criminal code to modernize it and bring it up to date. They've launched a new survey to that extent to gauge the public's... Well, it's called a public consultation, but it's really a public opinion survey. It does a bit of education and asks, what would you think if, in this fact scenario, if we did this, and sort of gauging the public opinion. So it doesn't seem like less of a... It seems less of a consultation and more of a sort of governance by popular opinion.
Do you
maybe
find out what kind of justice reform advocate you are at the end?
Yeah. You're a Law and Order.
Which TV show do you
Which Law and Order prosecutor am I?
Yeah.
I don't know why they're not moving it forward. I think they could. It seems like if they're looking to bolster their justice record, because they haven't passed very many justice bills right now, or over the midway point, this might be a good one, because I think this is something that everyone can support. I don't know why.
Even if people don't support it, like, it is the law already. So in the sense that, you know, repealing an unconstitutional law doesn't actually change the law in any way.
And it directly relates to the apology. Like, this is a section that people were imprisoned and discriminated against on the basis of this section. Like, it just seems like it would have been a no-brainer. I don't know why it stalled. Maybe the Justice Minister will come on and tell us.
Maybe.
Probably not.
I don't think so.
Can we talk about something else that's happening here in Ottawa?
Sure, I think we should.
We have a new Supreme Court judge.
Well, we have a Supreme Court nominee.
That's true. I mean, recently they've just been rejected left, right, and center.
Well, but now there's a new nonpartisan appointment committee that I think...
Is there, though? No, I'm just kidding.
I think
former Prime Minister Kim Campbell's on it.
Yeah, that's right. So
it's
nonpartisan,
I mean,
like, because
she's not conservative anymore.
And Justice Nadeau, I mean, come on.
That was a blip.
That was a blip, but I'm quite glad he went back to the Federal Court of Appeal where he agreed with you, Emily Tammin.
That's right. He was on the panel in my case. For those who don't recall, Tammin versus Canada.
Who won that?
Tammin.
Beat Canada. Why are you so anti-Canada, Tammin?
I will say this. I have a scheduled exam review session for my students on Tuesday. But at the same time that that's happening, law students are invited to sit in. Apparently, they invite students from across Canada. I don't know exactly how that works this close to exams, law students. But the Joint Senate and House Committee, which last year they actually convened that committee at the University of Ottawa campus. So I had a chance to go and see the questioning of Malcolm Rowe at the time that he was nominated and soon to be appointed. It's really neat. It's a neat thing for the students to get to sit in on. I think it's
a rubber stamp committee.
The rubber stamp committee. But, you know, it is. I mean, honestly, I had never heard of him before. I had never seen him before. And I've seen very little of him since. So, you know, for a lot of members of the public, it is an opportunity for the government to parade around their nominee, I think, more than anything else. So they've appointed a woman, a judge of the Alberta Court of Appeal.
A judge who, in 2016, this government elevated to the Alberta Court of Appeal. So a known quantity that this government at least knows of her since...
A rising star.
A former law dean, so has a background not only is in the judiciary, but also...
Are you just stalling because you don't know her name yet?
Didn't you say it already?
No.
Oh, Sheila Martin. Apologies, Sheila with an H. As Charisma Mathen tweeted out earlier today, got to start reinforcing it's the Sheila with an H on the end. We're going to have to remember that. So I know her name. No, what I was looking for was the thread that my colleague, Professor Vanessa McDonnell, had put out because she said some things about her background, but now I can't find it again.
I mean, it seems like I haven't heard any... Nadon-type comments with respect to her. No one's saying anything bad. I think that there are some things to sort of look out for that might telegraph sort of what she might bring to the Supreme Court. She's a law professor. She was on the Court of Appeal. She also has been quite outspoken with respect to sexual offenses in the criminal court, in our courts. And I mean outspoken in her judgments. Having very strong words for a judge that she overturned who relied on some sexual assault stereotypes and myths. She was, if you remember, the Judicial Council sort of opened up one of the judge school sort of training seminar conferences to some reporters a couple months ago. And she was, Justice Martin was chairing a panel on some sexual assault issues. She was also the appeal judge in the Barton case. And that's a case involving the murder of an Indigenous woman named Cindy Gladue, who Mr. Barton was acquitted at trial. That was sent back for a retrial. And Justice Martin spoke about it's a need to sort of reevaluate how we look at things in sexual assaults in court. So I think that if you're looking for the Supreme Court to maybe take some... be more activist on new sexual assault laws or new directions in sexual assault.
I don't care for the word activist.
I know, I just get another
Supreme
word.
Supreme Court, if you could find a different word.
But, I mean...
powerful.
Exactly.
Definitive.
Exercise her power.
Power. I mean, it could be something to look out for. And this is a controversial area, and it's an area that if the new Bill C-51 passes and we're looking at reverse disclosure of sexual assault records, it's going to be issues that are at the Supreme Court, and this seems certainly a judge who is well-versed in those issues.
Yeah, a couple of other points about her background now that I found what I was looking for. She was legal counsel on a couple of significant cases, including the residential school settlement and the wrongful conviction of David Milgaard. She's very active in LEAF, the Legal Education and Action Fund. So has, you know, I think a background working on feminist causes, and that would be consistent with what you were just saying. Apparently she's bilingual, which is something that...
Apparently Malcolm Rowe's bilingual too, but I don't know if I've ever heard him speak French.
I did hear him speak French at that thing, and it was actually very good.
Okay.
He actually speaks better than the low bar that they've set in terms of how they've articulated
your
French.
Was it answering questions in French?
Yes.
Or was it a statement?
No, it was spontaneously answering questions in French.
I'll be less suspicious.
His French definitely... I'm very comfortable with the level of his French, and apparently Justice Martin has good French too. So there are those... I count myself among them, but there are those who are disappointed not to see an Indigenous judge or a person of color appointed, you know, from a government with so much rhetoric about diversity. And I think this would have been a great opportunity. Having said that, you know, I don't know exactly who was in the pool, and I don't know the details.
I've heard rumors there are some good candidates, but I don't know.
Yeah. So that's going to be something that's going to be disappointing to some people, but it's not to take away at all from the credentials of Justice Martin, who certainly seems to be an appropriate appointment from what I can see.
I know the one criticism I've seen out there is that being an Alberta Court of Appeal, this means BC no longer has a judge. The sort of balance regionally has been, BC has always sort of gotten one of the seats, just as a nod, even though there's not a formal requirement for that.
So there are two from the West... And
there's now two from Alberta.
There are two from Alberta now, I see. Okay. Well, you know, that's fair. That's fair enough. But, I mean, the Chief Justice McLaughlin represented British Columbia for a very long time on that court. But no, that's fair to say. There's certainly a deep pool of talented judges in British Columbia as well. And I know when Justice Rowe was appointed, at that time there had been some discussion that they wouldn't limit themselves to appointing a judge from the East at all, from Atlantic Canada. And there was a lot of pushback on that because, you know, it's one thing to say two from the West and, well, maybe there should be more diverse. But if they had appointed someone, say, from Ontario, mm-hmm. I think that would have been problematic. So at least they've kept with the West, but that is a fair point.
Well, I know this, I saw in an article in the Globe and Mail yesterday before when they were teasing an announcement was coming that this committee had leaked the top three names. And the other names were Saskatchewan Court of Appeal Justice Georgina Jackson, and from BC would have been Justice Mary Ellen Turpo-Lafond.
Oh, yeah. She's,
who
she's
was former representative for Child and Youth and was the one Indigenous candidate. But I think Turpo-Lafond was seen as like the long shot given she didn't have as much judicial experience.
But if I'm not mistaken, her name was being bandied about the last time as well when they were saying they might not appoint from the East. I think she's one of the people that was being talked about as a potential. And I mean, to your point about BC... BC and Alberta aren't the only two provinces in the West, so yeah. I can see how two from Alberta.
What are the provinces in the West?
Like Alberta, BC, and a couple others.
Really? Oh, Saskatchewan. Is Manitoba in central?
Well we're
Manitoba?
In Ontario, right? So now everything's
west,
right?
I guess
Ontario,
everything west is west.
When I'm in Vancouver, everything's out east.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I've got a question for you about Supreme Court judges, Emily Tammin.
Mm-hmm.
Do they get their own custom-made robes, or is it altered and hand-me-downed?
So I'm happy to be corrected if I'm mistaken, but I believe that they get the existing robes. The robes are not custom-made. And the reason that's my recollection is because, if I'm not mistaken, when my mom was appointed to the Supreme Court, there was an issue because they have some kind of protected heritage status because the gowns have been around, and they obviously are historically significant given the people that have worn them. And for those who don't know, my mother is not a tall person. For those who know me, I can say she is shorter than me. And there was an issue because there was a question as to whether the robes could be cut or how, I mean, she would not have been able to walk in the robes at their length.
It'd been like a long train?
I think, I don't know if they had been Bora Laskins. And in fact, there was a joke when Justice Charon was appointed to replace my mom that they had just chosen another small Louise to fit the gown. So my understanding is that no, they do not get custom gowns and that they're modified to suit the person.
That's all I ever wanted to know.
That's what you wanted to
that's
know. What, there you go.
That's it right there.
There you've got your
I
answer.
Skimmed through the responses because one of the things Trudeau has done is put up the Q&As of each of the people who've applied.
That would have been a fantastic thing to look at.
The best,
before we started.
I'll tell you what, the best thing that I saw in there is they were asking her, like, what other extracurriculars have you had outside of law? And she said, like, to pay for her law school, she babysat, was a camp counselor, worked in the fast food industry and in retail sales. So does that match?
Oh my gosh, I feel like she's my soulmate. I did basically those same things.
And would you put that on your Supreme Court of Canada application?
I mean, I would like to think that I have some extracurriculars outside of law that post-date becoming a lawyer. Like, those are, like, yeah. I mean, I definitely was a camp counselor for longer than most people would consider appropriate for an adult. But I was still in undergrad, and I like to think that I've done some non-law things in my spare time, you know, as a lawyer.
Mine would be so bad. Be like, I once completed Double Dragon video game in one sitting. I also...
Dragon Veil.
Yeah. I also was able to master every King's Quest MS-DOS game in one sitting. Like, it would not be good. I'll just not talk about my childhood. It was a dark time.
Dark time behind a screen.
The other thing I did see her mention, in addition to all of the things you mentioned, Emily, is she was one of the Court of Appeal justices in Alberta who, there was that period after the Carter decision when medical assistance in dying was struck down, but not
it hadn't
available.
It had to go to the Supreme Court yet, yeah.
Or,
oh,
no,
no, it
after,
had, but
there
was
then you still had to delay,
go to court, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think it was even after Trudeau got the extension because he needed to write time to write a bill, and she authored one of the decisions allowing someone in a rush judgment and basically just reaffirmed the Carter decision, which gave a lot of assisted dying advocates a lot of excitement because it sort of put lie to the government's argument that their more restrictive bill was garbage.
We're going to have to do a little more homework on Justice Martin's criminal law record, which really is the theme of the Docket podcast. And although I know what you're thinking, aren't you a criminal law professor, Emily Tammen? Don't you? But, like, just saying, I haven't taken the time to fully characterize every justice of the Alberta Court of Appeal in terms of how they approach the criminal law. So maybe we'll have one of our good friends from Alberta come and talk to us.
I normally like to let other people do that sort of work and then just steal it when they tweet about it and then talk about it on here. But the Alberta Court of Appeal is a wacky, wacky place. So I'd be very interested to read the decisions that she was part of.
Yeah. So we'll do a little homework and we can come back on that.
Next up, I'm going to cut in a bit of my appearance on The Boys in Short Pants. In this, we talk about Bill Morneau's Last Stand and derelict vessels and secret ballots in Parliament, with lots of side diversions since we got a little distracted with the beers we were drinking. If you want to hear our full episode and the full discussion, find The Boys in Short Pants episode 32.
We just want to start by talking about, of course, the old Morneau Death Watch continues. Yeah, it's been a hell of a week for our friend Bill.
Yeah, you picked a good time to come to Ottawa to witness, you know, his final days here.
I was inches from being in question period yesterday, but apparently the Special Olympics team had dibs on the seats,
fair.
I didn't get
that's
in.
That's like, you can't be like, hey, get out of the way, you fucking kid.
Yeah, the whole gallery was full,
I didn't get in, but apparently it was everyone called for Bill Morneau's head day.
Yeah, it was, there was a lot of hooting and hollering in the people's house, as I mentioned on Twitter. Yes?
I was just going to say, it's sort of unfortunate. One of the, when you talk to sort of MPs and in the books that are done of like MP's time in the House, they always talk about like the level of decorum in the House and stuff like that, and how like
I was embarrassed when I had a school group. Yeah,
I was embarrassed at a school when we had school kids in, and I knew they were there and they were witnessing this in the House. And it's like, well, the Special Olympics team got one hell of a show about
really
what Canadian democracy was about—a
memorable one.
Well, I guess today was even hotter since Blake Richards, the Conservative MP for my parents' riding and where I grew up,
Banff Airdrie.
Banff
Airdrie.
Airdrie Banff?
Oh, man, it's
it was Wild Rose when I was growing up. There was Myron Thompson who wore his cowboy hat everywhere.
Yeah, he was classic. So when I was in New Brunswick, there was, I think, a convention for provincial electoral districts that they were in. If they were hyphenated, it was in alphabetical order. So, for instance, my writing was Memram Cook Tantramar.
I think it's by who is most powerful.
Oh, of course. So Banff could eat Airdrie.
No, I actually don't know. I think... generally, there's some sort of interesting... This is a complete aside.
Yeah, no,
and
it's
certainly not.
This is fine,
though.
There's some... We'll have to look into this. There's sort of interesting parliamentary procedure around how MPs generally are in charge of naming their own ridings.
Well, there actually there are a bunch of those going through the House right now.
Are there?
Yes, Chateau Gay L'École got renamed, or well, there was a vote on renaming it the other night. I don't know how it went. Presumably passed.
No one votes against the renaming of someone else's riding.
Yeah, and I believe there are several, quite a few of these that are actually on the sort of wait list right now to change.
If I were an MP, I would have voted against Sunshine Sea.
That's the best
Shining
one.
Coast to Coast, okay. Or whatever the hell it is.
Sunshine Coast, Sea to Sky Country. That's it.
Stupid name.
That's, I believe, Whistler's riding?
I think so, yeah. It would include Squamish and
all that good stuff. Yeah, okay, so that's a fun riding. Okay, sorry, so more
Well, Blake Richards gets kicked out today for...
Fondling the Maze?
No, that was the last guy in 2002.
Yeah, no.
As you told us earlier.
This was for Hooten and Hollerin.
Hooten and Hollerin. Yeah. He was asked if he would like to leave or be removed. And I guess he chose the latter.
So there were a lot of people heckling from both sides of the house today. It was a particularly rowdy one.
Yeah, it's been rowdy all week.
A lot of MPs in the gallery sort of observed that he wasn't necessarily the loudest one. He was just the closest to the speaker, and so he was perhaps the easiest target.
That does happen.
Because if it's, you know, the person in the far back corner, you're not sure who was yelling, then...
Gotta make an example of someone, and sometimes it's easy to go with the conservative who's right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and sure. I mean, the conservative benches are a lot closer to the speaker than the NDP ones, so the NDPs can... If you're, like, right on that threshold, you just say whatever you want, and you blame it on your neighbor.
You're light years away from them. It's not even a factor. So yeah, no, all that to say that the Morneau issue has been consuming sort of Ottawa's forebrain for the last couple of weeks, and especially this week, I'd say more than others, just because it's kind of reached a fever pitch. Pierre Poilievre had a very dramatic moment earlier this week where he was told, like, oh, well, if you can't say this outside of the House, then, like, blah, 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 because obviously everything members say in the House is covered by parliamentary privilege.
Let's actually expand on that. A little bit
I was going to explain what that means.
You weren't.
I was. Which means that they cannot be sued. Or they cannot
is that
be held,
how far you're expanding?
They cannot be held legally accountable for anything they say in the House. That they are, as members of Parliament, they can say whatever they like in the confines of the House of Commons.
Yes. Okay. And sort of this...
to the rules of the other MPs who could say...
Yeah.
Yeah, subject to the standing orders and et cetera, et cetera.
You can't say Bill Morneau is a chicken fucker, but you can say... The member for Toronto, whatever his writing is a chicken fucker.
No.
Or the minister.
That would be deemed unparliamentary language.
Well, we've just had this debate in BC because we're not allowed to use...
The Minister fake, for Corruption!
The fake parliamentary titles.
Oh, that's good, actually.
That I mean, isn't that one of them
it
were?
Was, well, the Minister for Gridlock, I think Corruption was in there. Minister for Propaganda had been used by the NDP.
So you probably
past,
can't call him the member from Renaud Chapelle. That would probably be out of order as well.
Yeah, I guess it'll...
That'd
there.
Be pretty funny. The member for Sonicor is my... We talked about this the other day, yeah. But yeah, carry on.
So basically what I think everyone is beating around the bush with all the Morneau stories is whether or not there was, you know, malice and insider trading and all these other things.
I completely forgot to get to my point. Is with Pierre Poilievre.
No, I was getting there.
Even more roundabout.
I was going to circle back. And so if someone were to make the allegation of insider trading against the minister and couldn't prove it, et cetera, et cetera, it falls into defamation and libel law and things along those lines.
Yeah.
So the Liberals have been challenging the Conservatives to make allegations of insider trading and other criminal activity outside the House, in fact, in the foyer of the House of Commons, where your parliamentary privilege expires.
Yes. There was a famous incident, semi-noted incident in the last Parliament, where Tom Mulcair referred to Conrad Black as a British criminal in the House and was challenged to say it again outside of the House by Lord Black himself.
This is sort of a once every 4 year thing or once every 3 year when someone wants to defend against their claim or someone's making particularly outrageous allegations. There's always the, why don't you say it outside the house?
In most workplaces, when you say, like, you want to take this outside, it means you're going to get into fistfights. But in this lame-ass line of work, it's like, are you going to get sued or not?
Just repeat yourself 10 meters from here.
To credit that, I think Ishmael Darrow made a very, very similar joke on Twitter the other day. So I'm not ripping off your jokes. I just forgot about it in the moment. I think he listens, actually. So
it's more about, I want to bring my lawyers into this kind of
thing. Yeah, exactly. Like, me and my buddies are going to... No, like, you're not even going to fight. It's just...
Tom Kamich made a good point about sort of the history and the sort of interesting, because personally, I found the my lawyers will sue you if you say this 10 yards from here, especially coming from Trudeau, who has effectively said that, seems like really off-brand for Trudeau, that generally you wouldn't have the prime minister clipped on the news threatening to sue the opposition.
Yeah.
Especially based on, like, parliamentary privilege and stuff that, you know, moms and pops watching aren't necessarily going to understand.
You know, the member has parliamentary privilege, as he should, but, and then was like, I will sue the pants off of you, Pierre Poilievre.
Yeah, so Kamich's point was that parliamentary privilege obviously exists for a reason, and the reason it exists is... It's sort of a protectionist measure for people who aren't in government to protect them and to enable them to say what needs to be said in a democracy.
Charles II shit there, yeah.
Very good reason so that you can speak truth to power.
That's the idea.
Well, and also the court shouldn't be able to reach into the legislature.
Yes.
Also that.
Division of power type thing.
That's a good one.
I was literally at the Supreme Court all day. I have to be thinking about these things.
And so you can speak truth to power without fear of repercussions, basically. And so the challenge is... It's just such a weird, like, say it outside. Honestly, if I were in the conservative OLO, my calculation would be, let's do it. Let's go the libel angle. The PCs in Ontario made a similar calculation recently.
They did.
Let's do the libel one. As soon as this story is dying down, let's go outside the house and say whatever the hell we want to say. Within reason, so that you have, like, a fighting case in your libel suit. But that's going to extend the media cycle. That's going to extend discussion of the minister for, like, years.
Yeah, that said, though, the Ontario PCs, I wouldn't say that's gone terribly well for them. But that may be more just a Patrick Brown problem than it is that particular
The eminently successful Ontario Progressive
Conservative
Party. So,
who is facing the least popular premier in the country.
And with the possibility of stepping on all the rakes they've strewn across their lawn in an effort to foil their foes.
We found another derail to go down.
To touch on the Patrick Brown one
very quickly, the case of Patrick Brown, for those unfamiliar with it, is Brown said something to the effect... that Kathleen Wynne is on trial, which of course is not the case. She testified at criminal proceedings of her lackeys.
Related to the Sudbury by-election shenanigans, which has since been thrown out.
But then when pressed by her legal team and counsel to either back down on the allegations and repent, which is fairly common in libel and defamation law,
I think usually it's recant, repent,
take your pick. It's a little more dramatic to repent. Never claimed to be a lawyer, although I did take a journalistic law class that covered defamation once upon a time.
I took a nonprofit law class. We're basically lawyers here.
There you go.
Yeah, I have never taken law, but I did study Latin, so next best thing.
Good. And so Patrick Brown's team, in this instance, made the political calculation to double down and to say, let's repeat it. Let's go to court and see how much good press we can, you know, make. How much milk we can produce out of this.
Very rural metaphors today.
And so I can easily see the Conservative government in future taking Morneau and Trudeau up on their challenge.
Conservative opposition. Yeah. We both got
that. What are you going to say?
You said conservative government.
Yeah. Ken's already had his
old
one beer.
Old habits die hard.
Ken's had his one beer. Okay, well, we've gotten very off track. At any rate, what happened with Poilievre is he then went out into the house. Wow, we really got far.
Out into the foyer.
Oh, yes. Yeah, fuck. We're terrible today. He went out into the foyer and then repeated a very, very toned down version of what he had said in the house. Very toned down. And you could say there was very little resemblance between the two statements, if one were uncharitable. And that has been sort of the story of the week. And there's been this sort of story that's broken today about insider trading, or alleged insider trading, I should say.
Always that alleged. Everything here is alleged.
Yeah, that frankly seems a little flimsy, but, you know.
Friends. In regarding his father selling of shares,
and even before that, Yes, you're right. The story today was about his father. Then before that, there was a story about him sort of introducing this bill to change the tax system and then selling his shares a little bit before that. Like, it's a little... It's as you were mentioning before we started recording, do you want to explain sort of the stock movement and how that sort of factors into the big picture?
So, rather than explaining it, I would encourage people
to... Fair.
Well, no.
Describe with words on an audio format what a graph looks like.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was doing it with my arms earlier.
That's fair.
I would encourage people to look at the Morneau Chappelle stock, to punch in the old Google Morneau Chappelle stock, to look at the stock history of it over the past 2 to 3 years. You can find graphs with this, where if you scroll over, you can sort of see the day by day what the stock price was at close of business every day. And you can see this sort of window where the stock was sort of going along steady, and then the stock dropped, and that is where sort of
the crisis, or
the point of contention is. And this was around December 3rd or 5th or 7th, 2015.
I think I've heard all those dates.
Depending on what specifically you're talking about, which is when the stock price dropped. And then it dropped apparently in response to liberals tabling Ways and Means motion in regards to their taxation, their middle class tax bracket changes, and increased tax. And in the global piece today from David Akin, what was controversial is instead of talking about the middle class, he talked about capital gains measures, which weren't actually included in the Ways and Means motion. They were perhaps mentioned, but the actual measures were not put into effect, and in fact have not been put into effect, much to the chagrin of the NDP.
So we have gotten to the Conservatives too. Oh, sorry, yeah, okay. My mistake. Anyway, we've gotten very deep in the weeds here. What do you think is the political upshot here?
The political upshot? I think it's the nail in Morneau's coffin. Effective... Well, so here's the thing. All of these things, like, the coffin is sealed. All the nails are in there. And the Conservatives are there with their nail gun, just putting more and more into it, sort of frivolously, because the damn thing's closed.
Yeah.
What needs to happen, though...
The liberals are in the corner, though, like, practicing some witchcraft, hoping to raise the debt more.
They're not.
Well, no, you're right.
They're biding their time.
Yeah. I think you're correct.
Biding their time. He has to get through a budget, and then summer prorogation, final cabinet shuffle.
I think you're correct.
Pitch him.
Though they have... or the Prime Minister has repeatedly said in the House, when asked if he has confidence in his Prime Minister, that he doesn't, and he's been a great finance minister, and that he's helping the middle class and all these great things. So I do agree with you. Their rhetoric, I think, also confirms that, in the sense that they are, like, hanging on for dear life for the next 6 months or so. But I think he will not serve out the term, and I doubt he runs for re-election.
So if you pitch your finance minister when faced with scandal... like, this amplifies the problem for you. It's a confession, basically. It serves as a confession to all your crimes. And to a certain extent, Morneau did this on a small scale when he sold off his stock in Morneau Chappelle. And although he never really conceded that it was a problem.
The argument was that he didn't do anything wrong,
but I just wanted to sell my stock.
He's got the... I didn't break the letter of the law.
Yeah.
Which is never a great argument.
No, he did.
He broke the spirit, and we all, I think, around the table agree that none of this looks good for him. No. But the ethics commissioner supposedly gave him that's not allowed.
Yeah, and we've talked about that at length in the past. Yeah.
And so I can see why he'd stick around and they'd hold him around just to...
Well, they
not
need to get through the budget.
They're
working them.
So perhaps a comparable example here is in recent memory, perhaps the most recent minister in a similar situation was Fantino. If you sort of just historically go back to it without going back to not Fonda, who was the juice?
Beverage Oda.
Without going all the way back to Oda.
Allegedly, Beverage
Oda. To just stick with Fantino was under, you know,
Beverage
similar...
Beverage Odwalla. Sorry, I'm done.
he had his struggles in Veterans Affairs, and the government,
you know, who is,
and the government kept him around for quite a while until he'd sort of weathered that, and then he was demoted. Take that as you will. This is sort of historically what governments have done when they're sort of demoting ministers, is you don't demote them when they're
under
fire.
You don't give the opposition a head on a platter, right? Like, you don't. You say, well, this person has had such a great career, and they're going to go out the side door now, and we'll never hear
of
them again.
I cannot think of a single instance of a minister resigning to calls from the opposition to resign.
Well, God, like when you see headline news, it's like, opposition calls on government minister to resign. It's like, they would do that any day, given the slightest excuse.
That's actually not true. I think the Conservatives have actually been pretty diligent about it, about holding off on this. And Polyev actually was interviewed about this and stated explicitly this, that if you call for everyone's resignation, people start to stop taking you seriously.
Fairly, yes.
Mm-hmm. And sort of, if you're always crying wolf, then, you know, no one's ever going to take you seriously. So if I'm not mistaken, to date, 2 years in, I think there have been two calls for resignation from the Conservatives. I think Harjeet Sajjan
over the stolen valor gate.
Over the architect of...
You're not just using gate.
Yes. Actually, I have to say, credit to the Beaverton for this, but like, I think one of the best Beaverton jokes they've had in forever, though they've been pretty good in general, was after they had that like world record length like confirmed kill with from a sniper. It was like Harjeet Sajjan takes credit for the longest sniper shot, that was pretty good.
So I think that was the first call for resignation of the Conservative opposition. And I think this is now the second one. And I would highlight that Morneau has been under fire since effectively...
August?
I was trying to think of when the small business tax changes were implemented. August is probably when it started to ramp up.
Yeah, because I mean, they were out of the... So, I mean, that said, the summer, like, they tabled this stuff kind of before the summer recess. And then they had the summer recess, and they got flack all throughout the summer.
Yes.
And then when the House came back in September, or mid-August, or whatever it was.
Not mid-August.
September.
Late September.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. I have a very poor memory. This is like, the leadership was all a blur.
The House never sits in August.
All a blur to me. But at any rate, yeah, like from there, like when they came back and just started shellacking him on this,
ethical challenges have been going on for months.
Yeah.
And so it is notable that the calls for resignation were very tactically chosen.
It started late.
In response to, and not to allege that Minister Morneau has done this, but if one were to be investigated for insider trading, this isn't the Ethics Commissioner doing this. This is the RCMP.
Yeah.
So this is a... If this ends up happening or
it could be criminal.
Whatever... It would be a criminal investigation, not an ethics commission investigation.
So, I think we've exhausted ourselves in Morneau there, and you can read Morneau news.
I've got
just
hours
about it.
More.
I know, we all do. But I think let's talk a little bit about a pretty wonky issue that's been in the House, and that would be included today, and that's the unprecedented secret ballot vote on C-352.
Yes.
I'll give a little bit of background on. C-352 is a private member's bill that was introduced by NDP MP Sheila Malcolmson of Nanaimo Ladysmith, or Ladysmith Nanaimo, depending on which convention of writing naming you adhere to.
There's no conventions. There's just an objectively correct one.
I don't know if I agree with that. Anyway.
This is postmodernism here.
Yeah. Postmodern neo-Marxism. Yeah, sort of.
Do you want to talk about Laurier?
Nope. 0% desire to talk about that. So at any rate, this private member's bill was about derelict vessels, which if you live near a coast, I guess is important. I don't know. I don't really...
We've never talked about it on Politicoast, but apparently it is an important...
Derelict vessels?
Yeah.
I'm not a...
God, I can't relate to this coming
from
the prairies.
I'm not a sea captain. Like, I don't know if this is a big deal, but apparently to coastal folks it is. I guess it gets in the way of their worshipping elder powers that dwell beneath the waves. I don't really know.
Or trying to launch your yacht.
Yeah, that kind of thing. So, at any rate, yes, it was a cleanup of this. And the Transportation Minister, Marc Garneau, tabled a motion that had to deal with various coastal affairs.
A motion or legislation?
It was legislation.
You said a motion.
What?
You said a motion.
Oh, whoops, yes. A piece of legislation. Curses.
Curses!
Yeah, so anyway, a bill basically dealing with similar issues, though it did not have exactly the same provisions, or even provisions really covering derelict vessels as such. So, typical practice when you have a private member's bill or motion, usually bills, actually, that sort of cover the same kind of topical ground as a government bill, the private member's bill gets thrown out by the House.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a couple reasons. So, basically, MPs can introduce in their PMB whatever the hell they want. And then
as long as it has no monetary impact.
So. Well, even that. Yeah. But through the course of business, a bill is deemed votable or non-votable.
Yes.
And so there's a number of reasons why a bill would be non-votable. And I've magically got the list here. So bills and motions that do not concern Parliament that are outside of federal jurisdiction. So if you have a bill on, you know, Uber laws in Fort McMurray, then that's not going to cut it. Bills and motions that clearly violate the Constitution Act and the Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
Sure.
If you have the Laurent Carbonneau bill for CSIS black sites, that's probably...
That sounds in character, yeah.
That's probably not going to make the cut. Bills and motions must not concern questions that are substantially the same as ones already voted on by the House of Commons or in the current session of Parliament, or ones preceding them in the order of precedence. So this is, I think...
That would be the government.
The one at play here. And to finish it off, bills and motions must not concern questions that are currently on the order paper or notice paper as items of government business. Oh, sorry,
I think this is the one. Oh, okay.
This is the one that comes into effect.
That would make sense. So essentially what happened here is that you do have two avenues of appeal if you feel that you've been hard done by this process.
Correct.
One is that you refer it to the committee, the Standing Committee on Procedure and House Affairs, PROC, and the other is that you, and this was actually only introduced in the early 2000s under the Paul Martin government, was that you put it to a secret vote of the House of Commons on whether the bill will be votable or not. And this is unprecedented. It has not happened before in the House's history. Because
this rule's only been around for 14
exactly.
years.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the rule was implemented in 2003, 2004, around there. So it has not existed for that long and has only now become a thing. So
tell me about the process
here.
Yes,
so for 3 days earlier this week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or perhaps just Tuesday, Wednesday, at any rate, a couple of days, there was a box in the House of Commons near the Speaker's chair where members could put ballots saying yes or no on whether the question would be votable or not. And today, the results were announced this morning. It was deemed not votable by a secret vote of Ms. Malcolmson's colleagues. Which is, I think, unfortunate, but there you go.
Is there any precedent for secret votes in Parliament?
Not that I can recall, though. You seem like you're trying to trip me up.
There would
so
be
go ahead.
Precedent based on the Speaker.
Woo!
Oh, you're right! Oh, how could
the
I overlook
speaker.
This? How
when there's
I
a competitive
this?
Speaker.
And so yes, Malcolmson, right. If I'm not mistaken, around a secret vote, there's certain procedural things. And Malcolmson had asked that the results of the vote be made public.
That was through the House Procedure Team, but yes.
Which is to say, how many people voted for side A versus side B, sort of thing.
The Speaker did not grant this request.
No, because he said, I'm going to base sort of precedence here off of the only other secret vote, which is the Speaker's election. I would note from my handy sort of procedural guide here as well.
AKA your smartphone.
AKA my smartphone, sort of a rudimentary Brian and Bosk.
O'Brien and Bosk.
I'm bad with names.
Yeah, you are.
That there's also another option that she may have chosen to substitute an item that had been deemed not votable with another item of private member's business.
Oh, okay. Oh, interesting. Like one of hers, or like she could basically get a free PMB?
I think she could have got a swap-a-rooney.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, because there's a lottery at the beginning of every parliament on private member's business. So basically you get a slot in the order, and often it's like... You know, they will just never get to you.
I mean, there's 320...
38 MPs.
38 numbers aren't my thing either.
But cabinet members don't get
private
members' bills.
Nor
so.
Do parliamentary secretaries, so that limits the list a fair bit.
Yeah.
So there's like 250 then.
Closer to like 275 to 300, I would say. Depending on how big you're...
Okay. Let's spend more time arguing
Harper
about this.
Harper cabinet, like 40 people or whatever. And then other parliamentary secretaries. Anyway.
Double it for parliamentary secretaries. Yeah.
So that was the Harper one, but this one's
smaller. Call it 35, double it, call it 70.
Yeah, but now it's like 60. So anyway, carry on. Let's keep moving.
Not this fun.
Yeah, at any rate, there are a lot of private members' bills. In many cases, the odds are very good that yours will never see the light of day.
And if it does see the light of day, the odds that it makes it through the entire parliamentary process are very slim, which is why a lot of MPs pick, like, I'm not gonna say frivolous, but legislation light, i.e. the day to recognize X group as, like, a national day celebration.
Or to designate the Canadian horse as the National Horse of Canada.
Or
that
National Hockey Day was Linda Duncan.
Was it
first bill.
Linda Duncan? National Hockey Day.
Yeah,
Edmonton, City of Champions, my friend.
Or
I mean, she was my member of Parliament for 4 years, five years.
I helped get her elected.
I didn't.
And then National Hockey Day came about. That was
woo.
I mean, that would have been against Raheem Jaffer.
Yep.
And
that was fun times. We'll get to cannabis.
At the University of Alberta there. Was it cannabis or cocaine that was at issue with Raheem?
He got cocaine, but he's played the Reefer Madness card against her end there.
That's
smart. Class act, right? Raheem all the way to the end.
So I think, that will segue out of this interesting bit of parliamentary trivia, which is kind of cool. It's a little bit of parliamentary history in the making. And, you know, it's a reminder that your institutions are run by nerds and you're all at our mercy, really.
But it means the astronaut will solve our derelict ship problem and
he
not
know.
The...
Well, it's like Event Horizon, but water.
Well, because her bill died, so...
Yeah, also that.
Yeah, so it's on him.
So it's up to
he
can see them from space.
A daring rescue,
Commander
like
Garno.
Yeah, he'll have to do it again.
Thanks to both the Docket and the Boys in Short Pants for having me back on their show. Make sure to find both of their shows on the internet wherever you found us, and follow them on Twitter.
And that has been Politicos. Find a list of the stories mentioned in the show notes at politicos.ca. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at PoliticosPod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politicoast. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.